Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A Supreme Court decision could have wide-ranging effects on the balance of power. And the Wisconsin Elections Commission issues a scathing rebuke to a Madison clerk. Plus, a new lawsuit seeks yet again to draw new congressional maps. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for July 11th. Hi, I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. All right, we had a slightly lighter news week than the last couple of weeks, but one of the perhaps most consequential Supreme Court cases that we've gotten in quite a while may have slipped past some people's radar because it didn't seem on its face like the most exciting case in the world, but this was Evers v. Markline. And this was a pretty major decision. One justice called it a constitutional revolution that took place this week, moving powers of the legislature over to the executive branch. So we'll start with a couple quotes from the opinions. We had a majority decision from the liberal justices. Jill Karofsky, Chief Justice, wrote that legislative action that alters the legal rights and duties of persons outside of the legislative branch triggers the requirements of constitutional mandates of bicameralism and presentment, of basically passing two chambers and going before an executive. Justice Rebecca Bradley, one of the dissenting conservative justices, argued that the majority invoked the Wisconsin Constitution to take power from the people's elected representatives in the legislature and bestow it on the executive branch, empowering unelected bureaucrats to rule over the people. Progressives like to protest against kings unless it is one of their own making. So some very strong words there.
Especially about administrative rules, which is not the sexiest topic on the face of the planet, but let's kind of explain for people, like, administrative rules process.
Well, what is an administrative rule? Let's start there.
So they pass laws, then agencies have to, like, implement them. Some laws give agencies powers to do things, like the Elections Commission. You can regulate elections. Well, what about when X, Y, and Z pop up? Well, we then put the administrative rules to empower us to do these things. Once they're in place, they carry the weight of law. Again, not the sexiest thing in the world, people at home, but there's been this kind of increasing tension between Governor Evers, a Democrat, and Republican lawmakers over what his agency wants to use, because the legislature wants to keep saying, no, you can't do that. We're going to keep pushing back. So this is a big deal. Brian Hagedorn, a conservative on the court, talked about during oral arguments that there's not really a clear provision in the Constitution of Wisconsin that says you can do this arrangement, where there's a committee, a joint committee of two houses overseeing administrative rules. He called it a gentleman's agreement. It's been in existence since 1966 and allows this to happen. But he also said if you overturn this process, you would basically overturn the entire balance. Most consequential case he said he's seen in the 5 years in the court.
That's
so, again, big words about a not very sexy topic.
Right, and we've had cases about redistricting and abortion, but this is the one that kind of rose to that level. And I think for a while it was being referred to with this sort of shorthand of it's the conversion therapy case, but it really wasn't ruling on the merits of conversion therapy. What it was looking at was a rule about conversion therapy and the process that it went through, where essentially what the governor argued, the governor who sued over this, argued is that this legislative committee was able to hold up a rule indefinitely, and that amounted to an unconstitutional veto. That was his argument, and the majority agreed with him.
So this process, what used to happen was if you objected to a rule, the committee would vote to introduce the legislation, they'd go through that process where they present it by bicameralism and presentment, the governor, and that way you could object to a rule. In 2017, however, they pushed the envelope. They gave themselves the power to have indefinite suspensions before the rule was promulgated and afterward. Now, they're big words, but basically, you have this process where the governor's administration agency proposes a rule, creates a scope statement, the framework of the rule. It goes to this review process. The legislature previously could object, suspend that process before it's even like put in place, say, no, we're not doing that, just via this committee. And they can do it indefinitely, over and over again. After the rule is put in place, they also have the power to indefinitely suspend it. Again, it's a committee by itself. That was a kind of a new trajectory for this committee compared to where it was before. That's kind of got themselves in trouble. And if you look at the broader picture, there's been like this string of decision last year about legislative oversight. Joint Finance Committee a year ago with stewardship purchases. The court ruled 6-1. You can't block stewardship purchases after you've appropriated the money. That's basically a second kick of the cat, they call it in politics, with financing. You can't do that. Josh Call, a few weeks ago, the Attorney General, got a unanimous decision. The legislature, through the Joint Finance Committee, can't oversee, can't regulate settlements in certain cases. Here now is like the three-headed monster of oversight, and it's kind of left legislature going, we don't have as much power as we used to have. We don't like it, what's going on.
And that's certainly what you see in those dissents, right, where Justice Bradley, as we quoted, talked about this being essentially kingmaking and moving power so far into the executive branch. What Evers' allies would say is that many other states, most other states, don't have a process like a joint committee that reviews the rules, that executives are empowered to pass rules. That's part of that division of power, and so that this actually kind of re-regulates things. We have some arguments from representing kind of the three arguments here, and when I say three, I mean Hagedorn partially dissented, partially concurred, essentially saying this should have been decided much more narrowly because of the scope of the constitutional kind of implications here. So from oral arguments in January, we have a little bit of video kind of breaking down those arguments.
Where in the Constitution did the people consent to being governed by laws, by rules, by regulations, promulgated by the executive branch, made by the executive branch? Nowhere do I see that the people ever consented to being governed by an administrative state instead of their elected representatives in the legislature.
You are basically saying that it is okay for three or four members of the legislature to put on hold something, to put on hold a rule that literally is saving people's lives.
The legislature makes a case, and I think it's a compelling case, that maybe what we have here is a sort of gentleman's agreement about how we're going to operate with government, right? Maybe it's not what the contract says, but maybe it's not what the Constitution says, but hey, this is how we've been operating for a long time. And the legislature's passed a lot of laws accepting the framework that's been given. It is a real issue because we'd be overturning a whole bunch that has relied upon what this court said.
And, you know, so there we have Hagedorn saying, you know, something that he said in his opinion as well is that there's a hornet's nest of constitutional issues implicated by this ruling because rules are everywhere, right? Like the other issue here, conversion therapy was the big one, but the other issue at play in this case was about building codes. So they are in building codes and shoreline regulations. We also see them quite a lot in our elections process here. Yeah.
Looking forward, that might be the biggest area where you're going to see a change because the Elections Commission, remember, has been at odds with Republican lawmakers, sometimes a small band of them, over various regulations. There was just this package of rules for election observers that took effect despite objections from Republicans. Remember, if you're an election observer, for example, at a polling site, you have to be no closer than 3 feet, no more than 8. There are all these things about where you can be and what you can do, what you can videotape. They put rules in place to set new standards. The Joint Committee Review of Administrative Rules deadlocked on suspending that rule and saying, we're not going to let you do these new regulations. That deadlock allowed them to take effect. It's a Republican committee, controlled committee. Usually they vote down that stuff. That's a rare occasion where it deadlocked. That's an example of where you're going to see an impact of the decision on your everyday life and elections going forward.
Well, and speaking of elections, the other kind of really big report that came out this week was from the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and this was looking at 193 ballots that went missing in Madison after the November election, or I should say right before the November election. They were not counted. And so there was a six-month bipartisan investigation into how this happened. The clerk that was involved resigned a couple of months ago. But what happened exactly in November? How did those ballots get lost? What were your sort of takeaways from that report?
The shocking lack of interest in moving quickly on this, I think, is a takeaway from the report.
Astonishing lack of urgency,
yes,
I believe, is yeah, how they reported that.
So when you have absentee ballots, they're transported from the clerk's office to polling places in Madison to be counted. They're put in bags, they're sealed. Basically, the conclusion of the Elections Commission was that the then clerk did not have an adequate series of safeguards in place to ensure these ballots weren't misplaced. Now, there are a couple of things, and we kind of knew a lot of that stuff before. They'd had these previous reports detailing shortcomings with how Madison did things. A couple things that stood out, though, was that the old Madison clerk went on vacation about a week after the election and didn't come back till like early December, like kind of checked out.
Yeah, that the commission said, why didn't we find out about this for 6 whole weeks after the election took place?
The second thing, there used to be a brewery called Ale Asylum in Madison, building kind of the near east north side. They were using it as a staging area, the clerk's office was. Now these giant carts that are locked, but they have tabulators in them and various election equipment for the polling sites. There were numerous people had keys to that building, and unauthorized people were getting in. At one point, they found somebody sleeping in the building who was supposed to be there. Doesn't paint a great picture of Madison. Now, the question, though, is the Election Commission will meet next week on Thursday, on what to do with this. The report lays out that it was overseen by Ann Jacobs, the Democratic chair of the commission, and Don Millis, who's the past Republican chair. They're pretty clear in their, and you know, the rest of the commission has to weigh in, but their report they oversaw makes clear they believe the clerk basically failed to follow the law, broke the law, whatever word you want to use, but didn't live up to state standards. It doesn't recommend any kind of like a prosecution. That'd be up to local district attorney if they want to do that. But the commission, when it first started this whole thing back in January, said, we don't want to punish anybody. We want to make sure it doesn't happen again. So now we'll get a watch on Thursday next week. What's the commission do? And two, did anybody from the Ishmael Zan's office pick up the baton and say, hey, there's a problem here when you go after somebody legally?
Right, well, and this has been, again, this kind of 6-month-long saga. And so the clerk had previously been investigated locally in Madison, and they found that she committed errors but did not argue that she broke the law. And so they have said that they are reviewing this report and they are looking to kind of implement some of those new processes. But it really was a very scathing report. And one of the things that I think is interesting, and especially as you say, coming from these sort of bipartisan commissioners, was this idea that these types of profound failures, was the word used, undermine public confidence in elections, right? So we have had 5 years now of conspiracy theories tied to the 2020 election that have significantly impacted our politics and our policies and election administration. We're still seeing laws and proposed constitutional amendments related to things that happened in 2020. And so then you have this series of errors, and again, this astonishing lack of urgency in kind of rectifying them. And the commissioners say that is really serious, even if these 193 ballots would not have changed the outcome of any of the elections, and their investigation shows that indeed it wouldn't have, that it really can undermine people's faith and will they cast a ballot that actually matters in a major swing state.
I get the impression some commissioners are offended because our count was wrong. So yes, we have an official count of what happened November 5th in Wisconsin, these races. It's off by 193 ballots. Again, didn't affect anything, but it's still off. And I think they're kind of really peeved to have that kind of on the record of like not having the right count for Wisconsin happen in a very important election.
Absolutely. All right, so next up, last week, of course, was the budget, and we are beginning to feel sort of reverberations immediately. So let's first go back to this whole hospital assessment deal that we talked about, the urgency of passing a budget by a certain time in order to avoid losing money through the hospital assessments fee, through the big, beautiful bill. What is going on between Governor Evers and Representative Derek Van Orden regarding that timeline right now?
So remember, the governor signed the budget at 1:32 a.m. Early July 3rd.
But who's counting?
Yeah. July 4th, President Donald Trump signed the big, beautiful bill in the law. And because of the timing, our hospital assessment is all good to go, goes into effect, more money coming to Wisconsin hospitals. Right away on July 4th, Derek Van Orden began posting on X about how basically he secured $1 billion for Wisconsin through the reconciliation bill. That kind of piqued my curiosity because there's no actual funding in the reconciliation bill for Wisconsin hospitals. Then he kind of started following his tweets up more and more, saying essentially that he was a big part of this deal that was struck with Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers. At one point, he suggested that Evers sign the budget because he told him at 1:32 a.m., because he told him to. Like, he needed to do this, and Evers responded, I'll get it done. Excuse me. That struck me as odd, because if you know Governor Evers, I don't get the impression from my phone calls that he's going to jump at Van Orden's request. So start making some phone calls and figure stuff out. Here's your timeline to remember. June 30th was a Monday. Reporters got briefed on the deal that Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers reached. It included this hospital assessment, which had been at 1.8%, now it goes to 6% of hospital patient revenues. July 1st, they released it. June 30th, I have an email from a staffer at the governor's office saying, hey, Derek Van Orden called. He wants to speak to the governor about this issue. We've told him that we're following what's happening with the reconciliation bill, but he is, quote unquote, adamant he wants to speak with the governor. July 1st, Tuesday, Joint Finance Committee votes on the deal, the final piece of the budget, sends it off to the full legislature. Evers and Van Orden speak. July 2nd, a Wednesday, Van Orden posts this letter saying, Governor, you must sign this bill quickly. We can't risk losing this money. Now, Van Orden is claiming somehow he was the impetus for this deal and the governor's actions. Obviously, the governor's office says, you had nothing to do with this. You weren't involved. I've been calling lots of people about this, and there are a couple things that are interesting. One, you know, Republican lawmakers were in touch with various members of the delegation to say, hey, what is going on? There's this kind of nuance in this whole discussion. Wisconsin did not expand through the Medicaid, through the Affordable Care Act, expand Medicaid. So we missed out on this federal money other states got for doing the expansion. Two, the way the reconciliation bill was worded, we were going to miss out on this other opportunity for more federal money because we were going to get punished for A, not expanding Medicaid, and B, not raising our assessment like other states had done. They're like, what the heck is going on, guys? So now this rush is going on. Van Orden, my sources told me, was involved in these conversations. Like, he was on top of this issue, but so were other members of the delegation. And this deal wasn't done because of pressure from them. It was obviously the governor in February said, I want to go to 5.7%. That was in his budget. They reached 6 because that's the maximum allowed. But you have to remember, too, at the federal level, the House bill first had a effective date of when this becomes law, these states like Wisconsin can't have a new tax or increase their tax. The Senate bill came out of the Finance Committee with a retroactive date to May 1st, which would have cut us off from doing this, even getting up with the reconciliation bill. That was changed in the final version of the bill, which also had the same House language. So boom, you've got the window that we had. Van Orden has tweeted that he changed the retroactive language. Now, do you believe Derek Van Orden has enough sway with the White House and U.S. Senate to get that number changed? I can't speak to that, right? But all this gets at, really, the reality is Derek Van Orden is trying to take credit for this because he also needs to shield himself from what is coming, which is an attack on the vision of the Medicaid provision, the big, beautiful bill. These reductions that have people worried about, people being kicked off of their health care, that attack is coming. This could be Van Orden's bulwark against that attack next fall.
Right. He is in arguably the most vulnerable mm-hmm. congressional district in the state. He already has multiple Democratic opponents, one of whom launched her campaign about 5 minutes into his new term. And so there's a ton of national money coming in to back his opponents. And so this could be a very politically wise thing to kind of try to claim credit for.
Rebecca Cook said she raised $980,000 in the second quarter, something like that. So we'll see real numbers next week. But yeah, she's a healthy clip for fundraising right now.
Yeah. Okay, and then also another budget reverberation here is a pretty rapid increase in tuition at the UW. We have video from a recent meeting of the Board of Regents explaining where that's coming from.
So the tuition increase is necessary, one, based on the bill that was passed, and two, to account for the inflation. Three, also to partially account for some of the things that we will now have to make up for that the federal government will be taken away from our individual campuses that support our students directly.
And this was a difficult recommendation for me to make as well, because we're trying to balance understanding that the state supports 1/5 of our budget, about 20%. There was a time that it supported close to 44%. And tuition has become a bigger portion of our revenue. And we tried hard to find the right balance in the recommendation that we made to the Business and Finance Committee. I hope we got there, but I also understand the concern of students and their parents, and we did not take that lightly by any means.
So Jay Rothman there is talking about declining state aid for the university system, and you and I were looking at some fun reports before this, and we found 41% state aid in 1984 compared to 30% by 2003, and now about a fifth of the UW costs come from the state. So a really significant decline in the last 30 years. But wasn't some of those wins for the UW in the state budget last week supposed to avoid something like
that? Yeah, well, it's a net $240 million in new state aid. And so Republicans, they're not happy because they just got this money and they're still increasing tuition on top of that, especially with some enrollment in fluctuations. Now, there are some campuses are growing, but there are others are not. So Republicans are like, what is going on here? It's not going to help engender the system to Republicans anytime soon.
Right. There's a, sort of that argument that they're just sort of continuing to build the bloat that they were trying to right-size in the government. All right. So switching over to a different election that we're paying attention to for, again, next year. The Republican field is growing in the governor's race. We had an additional person jump in this week, Bill Berrien, who is an ex-Navy SEAL and a manufacturing business owner. He joins Josh Schoeman, the Washington County executive, who's been in the race for a little bit longer than that. What do we know about what this race is kind of beginning to look like among Republicans?
A couple of things. One, Berrien this week, he had created a PAC earlier this year to promote Republicans and support sort of causes. He says he raised $1.2 million through that PAC. Again, we'll see reports on Tuesday next week, get more details about what's in there. Went on talk radio because he's got some questions to answer. He criticized Donald Trump. He backed Nikki Haley in the primary last year. He knocked Trump over his COVID response in 2020, how dare he, right? Like this is, you know, you don't do that in a Republican primary these days. So he's got some, he also sort of ranked choice voting. Republicans think this is a whole like scheme to try and get more moderate people into office, not fans. So when talk radio, address those questions, didn't go real well at times. So he's got some challenges there.
And I will say, you know, in the campaign ad that he kind of used to launch this campaign, he referred to Donald Trump at least three times, right? So really trying to make up for that by aligning himself very closely with him as an outsider and a businessman.
I'm going to shake up Madison like he shook up Washington, D.C. Like he's definitely embracing him. We'll see how it goes. You know, Trump, people will tell you, he's okay embracing people who once broke him because he loves that their loyalty now. Like, I mean, Scott Walker, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, they're all big opponents in 2015 and 16. Now they're like huge fans. MAGA voters, though, they have long memories, so we'll see how that goes. Schoeman today just announced he raised about $423,000 in the first 2 months after he got in the race. Also, there's a new independent expenditure group that's raised $200,000 just to help Schoeman's campaign. I don't want to diminish six figures of fundraising, but you know it's hard to compare sometimes. Rebecca Clayfish, her first week, she raised $1.2 million in 2021. Now, she had a statewide profile. She'd been through the recall elections in 2012. She was Scott Walker's lieutenant governor. She had a lot more connections than Schoeman does. So I know it's a fair comparison, but you can't ignore that here's a benchmark for you, and he is trying to get his name ID out there. So it's a little bit of a challenge for him right now to build that connection that others have had statewide.
And then the sort of elephant in the room is that we don't know who their Democratic opponent will be. Governor Tony Evers has not yet announced whether he is going to run. He did say he would make some sort of announcement after the budget, which, again, I'll remind, took place last week, so we're still waiting to hear. And so we'll just continue to see kind of how this race shapes up. All right, and then our kind of final thing for this week is a redistricting lawsuit over congressional maps. And no, it is not the one that we talked about 3 weeks ago, or I should say the two that the Supreme Court declined to hear. This is a different suit. What is this argument?
This argument actually was raised in one of the lawsuits. It was a friend of the court brief by Law Ford, a progressive law firm in Madison. They argue that this is a competitive gerrymander, uncompetitive gerrymander. Basically, these districts are drawn to be so good for incumbents, there's no chance of flipping them. Now, they acknowledge it's not a principle that's been recognized by a court in Wisconsin. It's one I haven't seen before, but it's a new argument raised about these maps because if you look at the districts, seven of the eight, they're not competitive at all. I think they have like the median winning margin in these races is like 25 or 30 points. You know, they're not competitive. The one exception is the third, Western Wisconsin, Derek Van Orden. That one is competitive at times. But even the first, supposed to be competitive seat, you know, Brian Slaw wins by 10 plus points most of the time. So they're arguing that this is violates the Constitution. Don't know about the legal argument. I'm not a lawyer. What's fascinating, though, is the process we're going to see here. Back in 2011, Republicans passed a bill that was kind of a companion to their new maps they put in place. That bill dealt with like all kinds of wards and that kind of stuff. It had a provision though that said if there is a challenge filed to a legislative or congressional district, the Supreme Court must, quoting a Legislative Reference Bureau document or Legislative Council document about this thing, must appoint a three-judge panel of circuit court judges to hear the challenge. They're supposed to be, you know, I've not gotten into all the weeds of how it would work, but that three-judge panel then would hear the case, rule, it can only be appealed to the state Supreme Court. No stop at the appeals court, right, the Supreme Court. Go back to 2011. There was a solid sort of majority on that Supreme Court that was basically going to be a bulwark against, or bulkhead against, like these kind of, you know, challenges to the congressional or legislative districts. They've been used before. That's what fascinates me right now. We're going to see, does the court have to do this? Like, again, it's in the law that they must do this, but I don't know if it's constitutional, like it's never been used. There was like one filing that kind of like started the process, but got dismissed back in 2011. So I'm really watching that. I think the filing said the court has like 5 days to, or the clerk for Dane County has 5 days to send up to the Supreme Court, say, hey, this is here. So we could see actions pretty soon.
Yes, and so maybe some more unprecedented kind of legal action coming out in the next couple of weeks. All right, let's go to the stock report. Who's rising this week?
So Governor Evers, so you know, doing the postmortem of the budget, lots of people are like, oh, this is a great budget to run on. You know, he really got a lot of wins here. But is he going to run on it? Let's first acknowledge, you know, this budget is much different than what Republicans have sent in the last several cycles. He got some wins there for sure. More money for childcare, more money for special education, Republicans want to do. More money for UW, they want to do a cut, they got money. Republicans got their wins, and you know, some of them glossed over a bit in the postmortem of this budget. Yeah, UW got money, but had all these like strings attached to it. They got a bigger tax cut than what Evers was proposing, so they got their wins. And when Evers, if he runs the budget, Republicans can run out too. They call them the majority makers in the assembly. They're the ones who are in swing seats. You can run and say, hey, I'm the same guy that, you know, same budget Governor Evers is running on. I'm running that one too. So good for them. Excuse me. But with Evers, though, it's like this weird tea leaf reading thing going on. I mean, for a year or so, I've been hearing the same argument. He likes the job. If his health is good, his wife's health is good, his kind of staff wants to remain in place, he's likely to run, especially because he could have a democratically controlled legislature, at least one chamber, after 2026. It'd be getting yeses instead of noes. How could you turn that down? National Republicans will say, you got to run because you're a sure thing. Not that he'd win for sure, but you've raised money before, you've won office, you've got good aim. We want you to run. But he'd be 79 in the third term. And there's just this kind of like look at the budget going, okay, yes, in 2021, he signed a $2 billion tax cut Republicans sent to him, and they made a major plank of his reelection campaign in 2022. He could do the same thing with this budget. You know, run on it. But will he? That is like the huge issue. Will he run on this budget? And it's also this feeling of it's almost too quiet to think he's going to run. Like, you have to build a campaign. The governor's got consultants all around him and everything else, but it's a little quiet right now. He seems a little nonchalant about it. So people are nervous. Like, what's he going to do?
We'll see. All right. And then mixed.
Howard Markline. So he got his first high profile challenger this week, Jenna Jacobson, who's a state representative. That budget thing we just talked about, Markline helped shepherd that budget bill through the process. Jenna is out there saying it's not money for education. Can Howard say, hey, it's the same budget that Evers signed, so why are you knocking me for? Other thing about Howard Markline is he's run above the top of the ticket for a long time. His district got way more Democratic in his last round of redistricting. Can he do it again? That's a huge question going forward. And looking at the four seats in general, they're all seats that are up next year that are really important. They're all seats that Kamala Harris won more votes than Donald Trump did in a not-so-great year for Democrats. If it's a good year for Democrats, it could be a good thing for them in flipping the chamber in those seats.
All right, and quickly, falling.
So JCRAR, just talk about what we talked about before. This committee has been neutered. The big question becomes, what happens next? Well, people tell me you got to like be more detailed in your bill writing, leave less interpretation for agencies. Do things like that. And the question is going to be, at some point, an agency could write a rule without a foundation, a solid foundation of state law. If that happens, then what's going to happen? Will the court step in and say you can't do that? Because this option is kind of like up in the air right now.
Got it. All right.
Oh, wait. One last thing before you leave. I think we have an announcement to make. So it's been 11 years now that I've been doing this show. I've had several co-hosts leave. It's them, not me, I swear. But you have agreed to step in and be our co-host at WeRewind with me going forward. We want to welcome you to the show and thank you for agreeing to do this.
I'm so thrilled to be here. I've been the WPR Capital reporter, I guess it's my title, State Capital Reporter, for about 2.5 years now. And so I'm really delighted to kind of get to share this space with you.
Great. Welcome aboard.
Thanks so much. And I think that'll do it for Rewind for this week. I am Anya Van Wagendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks so much.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.